Awesome. Thank you so much, Matt, for having me out here. This is my first time at LISA. I'm wearing a jacket because I live in California and it's cold here. Apparently, it's not even winter solstice, so that's crazy. But so I'm going to tell you a little bit about my journey at JPL, some of the things I've built regarding analytics and how we started to grow a DevOps culture. And hopefully, it's fun. I'm really glad we got to see the end of Caskey's talk to see all the crazy, interesting visualizations and things not to do. We do our best to try and make things useful for our engineers operating spacecraft on other planets. So, just a little bit about myself. I'm actually originally from Boise, Idaho, and I grew up there. I've worked at HP, worked for a couple of startups. I got to float in zero gravity with a real astronaut as my senior design project. And this was like my real hook into space. I was an intern at JPL one summer, and I was like, I didn't know anything about spacecraft. And I was like, maybe this is going to be awesome. And I came back with just on fire for space, for how we do exploration. So I had a really cool experience early on. And then I started full time at JPL, which is kind of like a Disneyland for nerds. We have all sorts of gadgets and gizmos, and we have a Mars yard where we actually drive our rovers around. For those of you, does anyone know, like, not know where JPL is? Okay, so JPL is in Pasadena, California. It's the only only NASA lab in LA. So what we do is we build rovers. Mars is our primary exploration target, and NASA will basically tell us to go build a rover for Mars, and JPL will be like, heck yeah, we will. In fact, we built like four. So the one that I started working on was the Mars Science Laboratory, or Curiosity, which is the largest one in the image there, and it's about the size of a mini SUV. We launched in 2011 and landed it with a rocket-propelled jetpack in 2012. So I've had a chance to wear many hats at JPL, playing different roles. Some of these hats encompass your entire body. You have to be in a clean room. We don't want to take our microbes to Mars. So we spend about 2 years building the spacecraft after the design is finished. And I had the privilege to be on the assembly, test, and launch team. So we're actually building the spacecraft, running tests, working with the hardware, and trying to make sure it's functionally okay and ready to launch and go to Mars. So one of those hats is software developer. Software development. So software is everywhere. And as like most software developers, we love putting comments in our code. Well, on spacecraft, we actually like sign a piece of the hardware. That's how kind of hardware works. So there's a piece of hardware there that I got to sign and put a little smiley face on. And then after we landed on Mars, we took a picture of it with Mars in the background. And we're like, this is cool. There's my Easter egg comment in my code. So what I was working on was the ground software and actually functional verification of the spacecraft. And some of the things I learned very early on was that building spacecraft is totally different than building ground software. It's the risk is much higher, the requirements process is much longer. Most of these missions take 8 to 10 years just to go from concept to launch. So it's a very long tail. But the ground software is typically more agile. You have a little more flexibility, a little more freedom. But why don't those two sync up all the time? Sometimes the spacecraft processes and methodologies leak into the ground software, the place where you should be more innovative and faster because you can change it. So one of the problems as a systems engineer working on this mission that I encountered many times over and over again, and I've been at JPL for almost 8 years, and I've had lots of experience with this data, and it's mostly telemetry. If you can think of an IoT use case where you have tens of thousands of little sensors tweeting back data, well, that's basically what we have from Mars. Our Martian spacecraft send about 15,000 discrete pieces of information back to Earth that report things like powers, voltages, state of health. And in order to actually use this data, you'd have to first query it out of an old legacy SQL database and then put it in Excel. And if anyone's ever tried to do that for a million values, you know it doesn't work out well. So you start using like MATLAB, which doesn't scale either. And then the graph was basically a PowerPoint chart that you would email to your colleagues and say, "Here, what do you think of this?" And then they go, "Well, what about this one little data point that over there? Can you go redo this work?" And this process is like a week, maybe two, to just to build a life of mission trend. This is a plot of the thermal values for one of the zones on the spacecraft. You can see the nice Martian entire year going from summer to winter and back to spring. And so when they told me what they were doing, I was like, are you kidding me? Like, why are you doing it this way? And like, and I had been doing it this way too. And like, there's got to be a better way. There really has to be. So the last several 2-3 years of my career at JPL, I would join the office of the CTO. And this is a place where we have a little more freedom to work with some of these newer technologies. So cloud computing, some of the newer databases. I was like, this is a problem that I've been trying to solve for a long time. I wonder if I can actually use some of this newer technology to it. So what we did is, within a couple weeks, brought in all that data that used to take, you know, weeks and days to query out, and put it in a search database and built a visualization. So I'm going to show you a quick video here of how that works. So now users from a web browser can very quickly see the exact same data they were putting into PowerPoint. They can zoom in, zoom out, and go down to the finest level of detail. And every time they're doing a mouse action, it's actually making a new query. These queries were happening in seconds and hours. Now they're happening in less than a second, going back into a browser, and it gives them much more context, and they can ask the questions they want immediately. They can actually isolate individual channels of information, compare them to others. I've been seeing an overall trend in just instantly. That whole process used to take forever, and now they can just very quickly identify minimum and maximum temperatures. You can see during the winter time, there's actually outliers that happen. That's kind of what's interesting when you're looking at these long tail things. Instead of emailing all these PowerPoint presentations, we can actually email links that are interactive. So when people want to ask more questions, they can ask their own questions. They get the link, they can click in around on the chart, drill down, ask their own questions, get their own insights, and it's a much more collaborative experience. It's much less one way. We also started bringing in other data sets, like the log messages that come out of our spacecraft. You can very quickly search and filter on these messages. And we get about 30,000 of those a day. And for added context, we brought in the images very quickly from another API so that we can actually see what the rover is doing while these data points were being collected, another correlation of information. You know, why was this temperature colder? Was there a shadow in the way that was making it not get enough sunlight? And so now we could instant context. So our thermal engineers were completely thrilled with this, and it really took off. And how we built it was completely different from how other software was built for missions. And it became so useful that it grew and grew, and other missions started to adopt it, and now it's actually the baseline for how we do a lot of our mission operations. So what we learned from this proof of concept was that search makes your data discoverable and collaborative. By being able to find what you're looking for, you can actually make better use of it and get to data faster. The other thing we learned is that because this was a greenfield project, we had a passionate end user, our thermal developers, going through PowerPoint and MATLAB, and with a passionate developer, me, who wanted to fix a problem, put them together in a very short amount of time. The iteration cycle was so vigorous that we had a working prototype in just a few weeks. It was an amazing recipe for how do you solve a really hard problem very fast. So now we have this new process. It has a bunch of new tools, and it's very different from what we used to see. We get data. We still get data from the Deep Space Network, which is NASA's infrastructure as a service, if you will. We have three sites across the world, Madrid, Canberra, and Goldstone. And at any time, we can speak to any of our deep space assets, either on Mars or in the outer planets, and keep constant lock on them. So we bring all that into Amazon's GovCloud, and using tools like Apache Spark, SQS, S3, we can very quickly process the data, put it in our search database, and make it available for our users within just a few seconds. So one of the things that happened at scale when we started moving this up the stack, we started porting this project to our Earth science missions. And because our satellites are much closer to Earth, we get the data rate goes up by orders of magnitude. So the database started to scale, things started to slow down. I was like, how do we fix this? Well, one of the things you can do is roll-ups. Some of you might be familiar with this concept. You basically aggregate your data out so that you can have a smaller subset that you're actually looking over. Now, what's interesting about this telemetry data is when you're doing those trends, what you're really interested in are the minimum and maximum values. So the min and max. You want to see where are the outliers. Did I ever spike voltages or drop currents unexpectedly? The averages are really deceiving. You see this flat line. You're like, where are my diurnal patterns here? How come it's gone. Well, the min and max are like actually what's pretty interesting. And with tools like Elasticsearch, you can actually do those kind of queries in real time and get them out. But it doesn't scale that well. So I came up with this way of doing the rollups, figured out a couple intervals, started indexing data, and you see massive reduction in the data size that you actually have to search over. This added some complexity, because now if users want to get the more fine-grained data set, they have to pick a different interval in their query. So the important thing here is that the API becomes a deliverable. We built this for them, an API that does the automatic switching of the intervals, so they're still making the same queries, asking for data, and actually asking for the number of data points. Your browser can't plot a million data points on the screen. It can plot maybe 1,000 or 2,000. So you just ask for 2,000 data points, it automatically figures out the interval, returns the aggregate data set, and they're happy. So this API became an entry point for new developers, existing users, and people interested in getting access to the data in a new way that was never before possible. Before, they were using Excel to plot things and SQL queries to get the data out. But now you have a RESTful API. We started to see this emergence of new dashboards. For example, this is a new thermal dashboard that is a complete evolution of the initial prototype that they built. But now at a glance, they can see multi-days, the important information completely tailored for their subsystem. This is not a general purpose tool anymore. This is hyper-focused for the team. They log in every day, look at the dashboard, they can immediately see what's going on. You know, one of the things I've heard is, you know, you have warning lights and status lights on your car dash. Why not have that for your satellite or spacecraft? Here you go. So we were able to educate our team, you know, here's how the API works. It's documented. Go have at it. We taught them how to use D3, how to use the other visualization frameworks for the web. And they built these very quickly. And the project was like, where's this coming from? This isn't part of our 4-year delivery life cycle. And like, okay, well, these people are building these things kind of organically and vetting them within their own team to make sure they're correct. This is a new way of working. So these have become the new standard for future missions. And what we started to see was that these really impactful, low-risk greenfield projects actually became and grew these little DevOps cultures within JPL. It became a new way of doing things. It was almost like an infection. Everyone started doing it this way. And it started to affect not only developers, but people in operations. And it was a new culture evolving. So with this new DevOps culture, we needed a way to actually deploy things quicker and more reliable. So containers were starting to get popular. This was back in like 2014. We started playing with this stuff. And we're like, okay, containers are great, but how do you make them run consistently? How do you run more than like 5 or 10 of them for one person? We started looking at Mesos and Marathon. This is a great platform it was solid, it was stable, and it made sense. This is pre-Kubernetes, which is now, you know, getting to that point where it's almost on parity for stability of Kubernetes or of Marathon and Mesos. So now we have this distributed task runner that we can run our containers, keep them running, and have a declarative, homogenous set of machines that you can deploy things to. This really accelerated our rate of innovation, because now prototypes and new software can be developed and run in production very quickly. So this was really Docker. I know you can't go to talk about DevOps without hearing Docker, crazy whale. But it was a really, for me, it was a breath of fresh air. I have been developing software and like trying to get it to run in a production environment, and it was a very long, arduous process trying to tell people like, okay, can you please install these packages? Oh, that's conflicts with another version on the machine. Oh my gosh, this is really frustrating. Well, this was a really good breath of fresh air for the developers and myself. It made me actually like software, writing software again. I was almost fed up with it. Unfortunately, it wasn't quite the ideal tool for our traditional ops and our SAs, because they were like, what is this thing? It's new. I don't want to do it. I don't get it. And so it became a lot of back and forth, like, okay, let's bring everyone up to speed. Let's enjoy this for what it is. You know, let's find out where it's right. Let's make sure it's secure. So we had a lot of deep dives in the security model, the operational model, and everyone started coming up to speed. It actually was pretty cool. So I started doing some things like, okay, how do you run things successfully in containers? Well, there's this concept of 12-factor apps, which hopefully some of you have heard of. But I was like, okay, we need to build 12-factor apps. I said this to my team, and they're like, no way. What do you know about running stateful apps? And then we bring in a consultant, and he's like, you guys need 12-factor apps. And they're like, oh, great idea. Listen to this guy. And I'm like, guys, I've been saying this all the time. So sometimes you just need to hear that external validation, going to conferences, hearing talks, reading books, having people on site. It goes a really long way for like getting your voice out there within your organization to continue to build these cultures. This is a classic NASA quote. Failure is not an option. This was Gene Kranz, a NASA flight director. And most of us practitioners would never say this, right? As all you know, things fail, and it's the faster you can bootstrap yourself up is what gets you back on track. But in the NASA's world, you have one chance to launch something, and if you forgot it or broke it, you're not. It's not getting fixed. There is no pit stop. There is no oil change on Mars. So in order to do faster innovations, you actually want to fail fast and fail often. I'm not going to poke SpaceX here, but you know they can fail, and they can actually come back. It's actually awesome. I really respect because they can have a rocket failure and be back on the pad much faster than I've seen, you know, some of the other people come to life. So that is that pattern, is you go fast and you do it fast and often. Same thing in software. But how do we do that? There's this concept of immutable infrastructure. I hope some of you have heard this. But it basically gives you a really strong premise for agile recovery. It lets you fail fast. It lets you recover quickly. Using tools like Terraform and Ansible, your code becomes, your infrastructure becomes declarative. You can burn down your entire stack and all of your infrastructure and bring it back to life by running a single command. This lets you actually have a real DR story. You can actually have two entire environments running, burn one down, and swap over to it easily without going through a multi-month cycle of, is this thing configured correctly? Having these tools is great, and it doesn't matter if it's Ansible or Salt or Puppet. As long as you're using one, what matters is that it's in code and recoverable. This is something that is interesting, that really accelerates, and it gives that delivery its agility, and that is continuous integration and continuous deployment. So one of the things we started to build on top of this containerized platform was a way for developers to develop, deploy, and operate their own applications, containerized applications. And it's a very simple workflow. You register your app, you go into your chat room on Slack, and you do the initial deployment. It starts monitoring your Git repository, and as you get pushed to your changes, it will rebuild your container and push it out. So I'm going to show you a little quick demo of how this works. So this is the continuous integration platform that that we built on top of Mesos and Marathon. I'm just going to kind of walk you through this. But our developers go to a website, and this is their onboarding process. And this is all self-service. They authorize their GitHub Enterprise account. They choose the repository that they want to deploy. And as long as there's a Docker file in that repository, it will work. They choose a branch they want to deploy from. They choose a Slack room that they want to have the bot chat with them in. They declare a declarative JSON response saying how much CPU, memory, what port is it running on. We also integrated this with the SSL provisioning and the DNS or infrastructure with OnLab. So all of that is completely automated now. They put in their username and password to do the SSL registration, confirm that everything was good. They hit go. That automatically triggers the app deployment. So now in their Slack channel, you have this bot called Jarvis, because naturally. They can just ask Jarvis to do basically your job, which is, let's deploy some apps here. So Jarvis, deploy my app. And he's like, we have app, naturally. And you can see here in the Marathon dashboard that the app starts deploying. There's two parts of this, the monitoring piece and the actual app deployment. The monitor goes. You can see the Docker build just got kicked off. So we do a Docker build, Docker push, pushes it to a registry using tags that mimic the Git hash. Once that gets pushed out, it actually deploys it to Marathon. And once it's deployed, the domain name that they registered is immediately available, and their app is there. when they want to make a change, all they do is open your editor, make the change in your file. You can see this demo was from a year ago. But so they make their change, they git commit. There's the change. We're going to add it, commit, and then we push. And then from the chat window, you can very quickly see, oh, my new build started. This is great. I didn't have to do anything extra. You see it starting, and the bot will actually help you. It'll give you information. You can ask it questions. You can interrogate it. You can ask it for logs. It'll give you a link to the logs. And so Jarvis starts building and rebuilding the new version of your app. You can see the tag is different. And it starts doing a rolling upgrade. So remember, the platform is automatically checking the health of your system, and it brings online the new one. And once it's online and healthy, that's when it tears down the old version. This is stuff you get out of the box from most all continuous or almost all container orchestration engines. And it really gives you that agility in deploying and building apps very quickly. So they've been using this for over a year now, and it's been great. We have hundreds of applications being deployed this way. It's perfect. One of the anecdotes from my colleagues was he was able to build a visualization, a Node application with D3, push it to the Moki infrastructure, walk over to his boss's desk, and bring it up on his boss's computer, and he's able to show him, walk him through what he did. He's like, this is unreal. It's a new collaborative way of writing software, and it's actually fun. Some of the new other features we're adding are like canary builds. We'll actually tell developers, you know, how much memory your app is using, whether or not it's configured correctly. And one of the things that I did with this bot, that's kind of a DevOps way, is anytime someone would bug me about something being wrong or like, I don't know what's going on, my app isn't showing up, I'm like, well, you don't have the right port exposed or you're blowing the memory budget here. Anytime there was a question like that, I go automate it. And so the bot now I just automated all those support questions so that they don't have to bug me so I can keep focusing on writing code and making the platform better. We built this in a very lean way. This is not a big system. It's basically taking all the API calls that are part of the system, like GitHub's API, the Slack API, the Docker API, Marathon API, and we just glued them together. So there's no real fancy tools here bundling together. So it's going to show you, like, you don't need a whole lot of stuff to get good CI/CD, or at least something that works. So this was like a proof of concept of what we could do on the platform, and it grew into something that's actually usable. If we were to do this again, I'd probably start to look at systems that are available now, like Spinnaker, which gives you even manual injection of actions for doing deployments to different environments, and it's much more powerful and has a great UI. So one of the important things to do is make sure you level up your team. You know, this is why some of us are here. You know, you want to build your skills. You want to launch your career to the next level. And everything is changing. You know, we heard from the keynote the other day. Change is happening very fast. You know, if you're not learning Go like right now, you need to. If you don't know about containers, you got to know that stuff like right now. So our developers and we have a team of practitioners. We have meetups on Lab where we share ideas and collaborate. So people aren't just like, it's not just up to themselves to try and build up their skill set. We actually help them. And there's a great way to stay up to date and stay on the cutting edge. Hey, who knows what spacecraft this is here? Hopefully some people, okay, a couple. Yeah, this is Juno. This is a spacecraft that arrived at Jupiter in July. It's a pretty recent mission. It spent 5 years cruising to Jupiter. So a lot of the people that like worked on that project don't even work at JPL anymore. So yeah, it's there now, and they didn't even get to like see it. But so you want to be able to stay on the cutting edge. How do you do that? You go to conferences, you go to your local meetups. You know, what some of the meetups I really like are the Docker meetups, the Elasticsearch meetups, the DevOps meetups, any kind of cloud or OpenStack meetup. This is where you meet and network with people and get help. If the people you work with don't know the answer, you can go to a meetup and someone might have the same problem you have and you might get a different answer. Some of the interesting sites I like to troll are Twitter. It's great for getting real-time updates from people who are in the meat of the problems. Medium is a great source for some of these reviews and even security, keeping up to date on security. Hacker News is okay, but it's kind of crazy. There's a lot of Yahoos on there, but it's usually a really good source for the latest. And from a development point of view, you know, if you're tracking a project that you're passionate about, something like Kubernetes, then look at the changelog. You get a lot of the changelog. You can anticipate what is going to break my system or affect my users before you even deploy it. And there, it usually takes, you know, maybe 5-10 minutes to go through a large changelog, but it's totally worth it. At the end of the day, DevOps isn't rocket science. This is, I got to have my obligatory rocket science talk slide in here. But it really isn't. You know, it's about using tools that make sense. If you're a developer, it makes sense. You know, if you're ops, everyone starts to work together and get up to the same skill. And so, and everyone's helping each other. It's not like, oh, I'm much smarter than everyone else, and so, you know, this isn't going to work. No, it's everyone trying to learn each side of the coin and meet in the middle. And it's all about culture at the end of the day and about the people you work with. The team of people you surround yourself with are the people that are going to make you the most successful. And, you know, it's not easy working with different organizations, but it's worth it at the end of the day. And these are the people that you see every day, so you want to get along. JPL has always had a long tradition of large teams working on huge projects. This is just some of the people that worked on the Mars Science Laboratory rover. I'm like somewhere there. I'm the guy in the blue. At one point in time, we had over 3,500 engineers working on that project, and there's barely 200 there. So, but the people you surround you with is what will make you the most successful. So whatever you decide to do and however you do it, what matters is building that culture, having those open lines of communication, building tools that are useful and actually get you closer to writing that business logic and making the answers that your business cares about. And hopefully, for us, in our case, it's the search for life in our universe. Thank you very much. Whoa, another question.
I don't know. Is it Tom? Okay. So one of the questions that I had was that I saw you guys built a ton of new instrumentation, new processing, new visualization for the tools that you guys built. How much of the existing legacy stuff got ported over to the new way? Because I've seen in projects where you have really entrenched solutions that people are very kind of emotionally attached to sometimes, there's a lot of hesitancy.
Yeah, that's a great question. What happened to the old systems? Are they still there? And the answer is yes. Because they don't change very fast. What we did is we continue to run these systems in parallel. So people start to use the newer systems, they get used to them, but now we need to basically infuse what we've done into the old system. So they're doing that now. They have about a 5-year development cycle and re-architecture that they're doing. It's like, hey, this actually works, so we're going to infuse that technology into the next mission's ground system. So until then, you know, these systems will continue to run in parallel and people will continue to use them, but it is a long tail architecture replan and rebuild lots of people to make that original system good. And the way we did that is actually the record of store is still in that gold source, that legacy database, if you will. So we don't actually perturbate or change that record of store at all. We did everything in a safe environment for prototyping. We copied the data. And in this case, that was great. It let us move much faster without actually affecting these mission systems that took years to plan and deploy and build.
I got a question for you about the rover itself. When you're building for NASA and it goes up over to Mars, is it handed off completely over to NASA, or are any changes, code updates done by JPL?
That's a good question. Who operates the spacecraft? JPL, you know, we most of our work is NASA, and we have missions, and we actually build, test, launch, and operate the missions from JPL. That's why we have our infrastructure as a service at the Deep Space Network. So we get all the data ourselves. We bring it back to JPL. So there are people at JPL actually operating the mission. We work. We're not NASA employees, but we are designated operators and flyers of the spacecraft. There's a fairly large team. And what's interesting about the Curiosity rover is that it's a joint mission. There are other countries that built instruments on board. So we have people in Russia, people in France, that all contribute to the daily operations of the rover. So it's like a very collaborative all-day telecon in order to plan what the rover is going to do that day.
I was wondering, maybe it's not necessarily directly related to the topic. How do you do this locally with the containers? What is your experience? Because there is a pain point in your configuration when you deploy, it's fine. But, the file system, the mount points in the host and this deal, you must have been through the hurdles. You've seen the dead fish, right? Can you expand on that?
Yeah, that's a good question. How did we grow up with containers, with all of its edges around security, volumes, networking? And it really has been an evolution of the process. Mesos and Marathon has, moved fairly slowly in the adoption of some of these newer ways of working with file systems. For our continuous deployment, we basically said, it's got to be a stateless application or you host the database somewhere else. So until we have a self-service storage solution for persistent data, we're basically deferring that until we're isolating the types of workloads you can run. You got to run your own database if you want to continuous deploy your application. So it's not actually for stateless applications. Now, for the more stateful things like Elasticsearch we run on Marathon, that's a more carefully crafted deployment where we use a lot of the primitives within Marathon to isolate the application onto a specific fleet of nodes. We mount the data points so that the volume is there, and then we kind of rotate them around for rolling upgrades within that fleet of machines. So using containers for the isolation of the packages, the JVM, the constraining of the memory so that we can handle gracefully all the memory overflows, as well as the continuous monitoring of the database. All that stuff is handled by the platform.
It's kind of a follow-up to that question. So did you containerize Hadoop, and what was the decision behind going with Mesos over Yarn and other bits? And I'm also curious how you got what your personal path, hardware to software, how did you wind up where you were? So those are my two. And thank you.
Yep. Good question. So how did we build our ETL pipeline? We do have a Hadoop infrastructure, but a lot of the ETL is converting text-based files into JSON so they can then be ingested. We wanted that to all be automated. So we kind of built our little mini batching system. This is a pretty common design pattern on Amazon, but you use a queue like SQS to notify when messages arrive from S3. So the hardware, as soon as it arrives from the Deep Space network, it just copies the file to S3, and that triggers a message which populates a queue, and then we spin up Spark workers that are in containers. So we're not actually using the Spark full cluster or anything. We don't need that for this small data. So that creates basically a fleet of workers that consume the queue, ingest the data, do the transforms, and we can scale it up and down depending on how much data is coming in. We also use Hadoop, a more standard like EMR cluster, for doing large transformations. And that's like a one click, give me my cluster, point it at S3, do massive transformations for multiple days, and then you shut it down and you're done. So that's it's definitely part of it. I've seen many efforts of getting Hadoop to run on Yarn, getting Yarn to run on Kubernetes. I've had done a lot of work on that too, and it's actually an interesting way of making your workloads for Hadoop portable. You don't need to have a dedicated Hadoop instance. If you have a Kubernetes cluster, you can spin up Yarn and then run things like Hive and Zeppelin for Spark in a more agile, portable way. Personal history with I got into software? Oh, good question. How did I evolve into the ops and software world? So I've always been interested in software. I started working with software early on at HP doing firmware tests. And when I started at JPL, I was actually an electrical engineer. But software is everywhere. And so even though you're doing electrical engineering I didn't really do much electrical actual circuit design, and it was mostly automation of systems. You know, if you're in a test bed working with lots of hardware, how do you automate those processes to make them run more efficiently? So it's taking the task that I was doing as a systems engineer and making them better with software. And that comes with all of its hurdles and interesting things. You build tools to help with the engineers, and then you need to deploy them. And before you know it, you're deploying them yourselves and working with the SAs even closer. And then you start jumping into the container world, and things start moving really fast. And before you know it, like everything you do is in the cloud, and you're spinning up your own instances, doing your own upgrades, your own security patches, and working even closer with the security team and the operations teams. So it's kind of an evolution of building things that are useful in software and then learning how to operate them. So I came from like the developer to ops versus like ops to developer or whatever. So that was kind of my personal path.